can feel myself blushing. Well, we needed a holiday, I say lamely. Jamie turns to me, frowning, as the police officer consults his notes, and I throw my hands up as if to say, I panicked. So you're saying this house belongs to a Philip and Tara Haywood? He continues, glancing up at Jamie. Yes. And I assume you have details for them? I do, I say. I disappear into the living room to get my phone, and then trot back to the kitchen, reeling Philip's number off and then policing scribbles it down. I can feel the tension coming off Jamie like steam. I have to concentrate on keeping my hands and legs still. I want to run. Run far away from this place. Have you spoken to Tara Haywood at all? He says, looking from Jamie to me. No, I've just spoken to Philip on the phone, I say. So you've not seen Tara? I've not seen either of them. It was all conducted by phone after the leaflet came through the letterbox. Right. Of course. He rubs his hand over his chin. Obviously we're going to contact the Haywards, but unfortunately you can no longer stay here. Are they still at your property? No, says Jamie. Philip spoke to my wife yesterday to say they were leaving. So you can return to your flat? His eyes are hard as he assesses Jamie. Well, yes, it looks that way, says Jamie. That might be for the best, but we will need to talk to you again, and you'll need to give us the key to this house and your address in Bath. Jamie gives the officer our address. The younger policeman has peeled back the bifolds and is standing in the garden, looking down at the hole in the ground where Ziggy must have found the basque. The rain is so heavy that a mist has formed, thick and grey, so that I can no longer see the steps that lead to the beach. What will they do now? Will they get a team in and comb the garden, looking for further evidence of a crime? I think of the implements in the basement, the scalpels and knives. Philip's used to skinning animals. He's a surgeon. Has he hurt Tara? Have we been living in the house, oblivious while all this time she's buried somewhere in the garden? Jamie's unusually quiet on the drive home. The rain's so heavy that the wipers are on full speed and they squeak as they pan back and forth. We're both in shock, silently reeling from what we found back at the house. The other things, the taxidermy in the basement, the surveillance equipment, the skull in the tree, the footprints, even Jim, are bad enough. But the underwear, the blood. Every time I recall it, a chill runs through me. I worry about Jamie, driving the 3-hour journey when he's still ill. He's tried to convince me in the past to get back behind the wheel to practice, gain confidence, but I've refused. I've told him I'm scared of having that responsibility. I can't be in charge of a machine that could potentially kill someone. It's dark by the time we pull into our street. Jamie manages to find a parking space right outside our building. I'm relieved to be home. My stomach clenches every time I think of walking back into our flat. What if the hay was left behind? The pavement is polished with rain. I get out of the car and stand, staring up at the familiar creamy Bath stone walls with the blackened stain around the middle, so it looks like the house is wearing a belt. Evelyn's lamp glows from behind her lace curtains. I can just about make out a silhouette, sitting in the chair by the window. Her knitting needles no doubt clacking away. It's reassuring to see her. She barely sleeps, so she told me once. I peer over the railings to our basement flat. The windows are dark, I observe with relief. The Haywards must have already left. If Tara was ever there, that is. It did cross my mind earlier to ring Philip's mobile, but when I voiced it to Jamie, he told me to let the police handle it. I stand with Ziggy, as he sits on the wet pavement under the street lamp, his tail wagging half-heartedly. The raindrops shimmer under the light. Jamie drags our suitcase towards me. Home again, jiggity jig, he says. It's something we always parrot whenever we've been away for longer than a day. Like a talisman. I know he's hoping it will be lucky now, as he adds. You definitely think they've left? I bloody hope so. Jay, what a nightmare. He leans in and kisses me tenderly. His eyes tired. And then he takes a deep breath, as though bracing himself. I squeeze his hand in reassurance as I follow him down the stairs, gingerly, expecting Philip Hayward to come storming out of our front door at any moment, maybe with a scalpel. Jamie throws me a wan smile as he turns the key in the lock. My heart is in my mouth, terrified of what we might find. He pushes the door open, and I follow with apprehension, surprised by how narrow our hallway is. How cramped our living room and kitchen, even though in the past I've always thought they were generous for a two-bedroom flat. After living at the hideaway for 5 days, I've become used to all that space. I let Ziggy off his lead, and he charges in and out of the rooms, happy to be home. "Everything seems in order," says Jamie, with relief, standing in the middle of the kitchen and glancing around at the wooden IKEA units. They look tatty, after the slick gloss of the Haywards' designer kitchen. My eye goes to the chip in the black laminate worktop, the missing tile above the cooker and the white paintwork that needs freshening up. Everything's how we left it. "It smells different," I say. A scent hangs in the air that wasn't evident before. Not perfume exactly, more incense. And there's an empty glass on the worktop. I pick it up and examine it, noting the lipstick on the rim. A dark purple smudge. "So a woman has been here. Tara?" I place the glass in the sink, not sure what to think. Jamie leaves the room, and I flit around the kitchen, opening and closing the cupboard doors, even peering into the dishwasher. All as we'd left it. Apart from the glass, nothing's out of place. I find Jamie sprawled on our shabby sofa that's covered in dog hairs, looking more relaxed than he ever did on the Haywards furniture. But his pallor is grey with exhaustion. I perch next to him, worried. "Are you all right?" "Just tired." "I'll make a cup of tea." I leave him lying there, watching an old episode of QI, and go to our bedroom. I stand in the doorway, assessing the room, wondering about the couple who've slept in our bed. I feel violated somehow, knowing that they've stayed here. Feeling as though our lovely flat, our sanctuary, has been tainted by something unseen. Almost as though an unsavory spirit has pervaded the place, changing the energy. I run my hand over the duck egg blue duvet cover. It looks rumpled, as though recently used. In a sudden frenzy, I pull the cover from the duvet and rip the sheets from the bed, bundling it all up and shoving it into the washing machine. I put clean linen on the bed and then slump to the floor, my broken arm aching. My eye catches something on the floor by my bedside table, and I bend down to pick it up. It's a silver necklace. A St. Christopher. Its fine chain sliding between my fingers. I frown. A memory blooming and then fading in my mind so that I can't quite grasp it. I drop the necklace into the pocket of my cardigan. I guess I've looked after the place. There's no doubt about that. It's almost as though they haven't been here. If it wasn't for the glass, the rumpled bedding and the strange smell in the air, I'd have assumed the place had been standing empty. Then I remind myself that they probably haven't been here much anyway, spending most of their time at the hospital with their daughter. I'm contemplating whether to get the vacuum cleaner out, or if it'll disturb Evelyn above us, when I remember Jamie's cup of tea. Then I hear a shout coming from the spare bedroom. I dart in there. "What is it? What have you found?" Jamie's standing over his desk, shaking his head in confusion. "I think they've stolen my work folder. It's gone, the client list I was building, their names, how much they owed me. Don't you have records on your computer?" "Of course I do." He sounds exasperated. "But I also made hard copies. They've obviously been in here, rifling around." He bends over and starts pulling at drawers and rummaging through the endless paperwork that he's never got around to sorting out. "Why didn't you lock the drawers?" I ask in dismay. He stands up and runs his hands through his hair in frustration. "I didn't think. What the hell are they planning to do with my folder?" I'm trying not to panic, because that would tip Jamie over the edge. He doesn't often lose his rag, but his illness compounded with the long drive and the shock of what's happened on holiday has taken its toll. We should have locked the desk or hidden our paperwork. Everything important is in this study. Our bank statements, our mortgage details, our deeds for the flat. The filing cabinet's heavy as I hold the drawers open, my heart in my mouth. Please let everything be in order. I will, as my fingers flick through the papers. I'd suggested the house swap in the first place to give Jamie a break, but he's only succeeded in making him more stressed. Jamie, I cry when I find the folder he's looking for. He's here! He's by my side in an instant. I hand it to him, and his whole body visibly relaxes. Oh, thank God, he says. I was so sure I'd put it in my desk drawer. It doesn't look like anything's been taken, Jay, don't worry. But later, as we lie in bed listening to the comforting sounds of the Bath traffic outside our window and the occasional ambulance siren, I know that my fears at the hideaway weren't solely down to PTSD. There had been reason to worry. The strange things that took place there. The man at Lizard Point. The bloodied underwear in the garden. Maybe even Jamie's food poisoning. It was all connected somehow. And despite Jamie's protestations to the contrary, after the way he overreacted about his folder, I know that deep down he thinks so too. 14. The next morning, I leave Jamie in bed to recover and knock on Evelyn's front door. It occurred to me during the night when I woke up in a cold sweat that she would have met Philip and Tara when they came to collect and give back our spare key. Evelyn's weathered face breaks into a huge grin when she sees me standing on her doorstep. She seems to have aged in the week since I last saw her. Evelyn is tiny, not even 5 feet tall, and walks with a stoop. Her silver hair is always tied back into a neat bun at the nape of her neck. Libby, my love, come in, she says, beckoning me over the threshold. I step into the hallway. I love Evelyn's flat. It's the two floors above ours, with original Victorian cornicing, high ceilings and patterned floor tiles in the hallway, creams and browns, with a blue flower at the centre of each square. Not to mention the huge garden, which would be perfect for Ziggy. Jamie confided in me once that he hoped by the time Evelyn was ready to move on, we would have enough money to buy her place. I know his move on was really a euphemism, but the thought of Evelyn dying is too upsetting to think about. I follow her into her elegant front room, she calls it the drawing room, and sit down on one of her Louis XVI style chairs. I thought I'd heard you come home last night, she says, after offering me a cup of tea, which I decline. I've completely gone off tea. I hope we didn't disturb you. Her eyes twinkle. Not at all. You know me, never sleep. Did you have a lovely holiday? She leans forward in her chair and studies my face. She has this way of looking at you so intently, it feels like she can read your every thought. I find myself telling her everything then, the words spilling out of my mouth in desperation to unburden myself. She flinches when I describe finding the torn, bloodied clothing. When I'm finished, she looks at me steadily. My goodness, she says eventually. That's quite some holiday. I burst out laughing. I can't help it. It feels like a release. She laughs too, and then her face grows serious again. It all sounds very strange, Libby, particularly the clothing. Do they think it's Mrs. Hayward's blood? I fidget. They haven't said yet, but it looks like the kind of thing she'd wear. I try not to squirm under her unwavering gaze. I notice some similar items in a drawer. I haven't been explicit about what clothing we found. I feel uncomfortable talking about Basques to my 80-year-old neighbour.
The thing is, Libby, my love, you knew nothing about them before you let them stay in your flat, did you?
I grimace. She notices.
Oh, I know it's what you young people do nowadays, with all this air nub nonsense.
I assume she's talking about Airbnb. I don't correct her.
But I don't know, she continues. You're letting strangers into your life, aren't you? With all their funny ways, all their baggage, I'm not just talking about their suitcases.
I'm worried, though, Evelyn, about Tara. Obviously, I'm going to assume something violent has happened, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, of course. Did you see them? Both of them, I mean. Did they both come to pick up the key on Saturday?
Yes, a man came. Youngish, older than you. Maybe mid-30s, I couldn't say exactly. When you get to my age, everybody looks young.
She chuckles and sits back in her chair, folding her pale hands in her lap. The veins crisscrossing her skin are a lumpy blue-green. My heart goes out to her, imagining her sitting in this room day after day with only her memories and the many photographs that line the mantelpiece for company. I make a vow to myself to come and visit her more often. As far as I'm aware, she never has any visitors. She mentioned a nephew once. I remember because she described him as her only living relative, who was unlikely to procreate because he's a homosexual. She'd whispered the word homosexual, as though it wasn't supposed to be spoken aloud, reminding me that we were from different eras, despite the fact that she's one of my closest friends.
Was a woman with him? His wife?
It isn't until I ask that I realise how desperately I wanted to say yes. The thought that Philip has killed Tara at the hideaway and buried her in the garden for my dog to find is too horrific to contemplate. She shakes her head, silver tendrils of hair bouncing around her jawline.
No, he turned up for the key alone. Although a few days later, the Wednesday, I think.
She squints as she tries to recall it.
Yes, it was definitely a Wednesday because the recycling man came. Anyway, I saw a woman outside, by the bins. It was quite dark.
Oh, thank goodness, I say, exhaling with relief. So Tara was with him, which means she's still alive. But if it isn't Tara's underwear that we found in the garden, then whose is it? Her expression darkens.
You know, he never returned with the key. In fact, I got the sense that he was hardly at your place. No lights were ever on, apart from that first night.
Maybe they were at the hospital. They might have been able to stay the odd night with their daughter.
I suppose. I did hear a bit of noise. I'm sure it was yesterday, but it might have been Wednesday.
She frowns.
One day merges into another for me.
What sort of noise?
A bit of shouting. A sort of scuffle. Banging, I think. They might have been having an argument. I heard a woman's voice.
It could have been about their daughter. Stressful time, I'd imagine.
Perhaps,
she says, but I can tell by her expression that there's something else she's not telling me. I'm craning forward in my seat. What is it, Evelyn? She shakes her head again, as if to dispel any unpleasant or uncharitable thoughts about Philip Hayward.
Nothing, really. He just seemed a bit odd, that's all. A bit agitated, but of course he was probably worried about his daughter.
I fill her in on his phone call and how he'd left earlier than planned. Maybe forgot to leave the key in his hurry, I say, trying to swallow down my alarm that he still has access to our flat. Maybe I should have drawn up a contract. I'd been too trusting, assuming there'd be no issues if it was a swap. She nods in agreement, but her kind eyes are troubled, or maybe puzzled. I can't quite work it out. It's as though she's trying to access a thought or concern that is just out of reach. But I don't want to probe too much. Just in case it has nothing to do with Philip Hayward at all. As I go to leave, kissing her papery cheek, she places her crinkly hand on my arm and says, her voice serious,
I would get those locks changed, Libby, love. Just to be on the safe side.
The locksmith is here within hours, and I relax a bit, knowing Philip Hayward can't get in. I try to ring his mobile a few more times, but each time it just rings out. I can't resist searching the Cornish newspapers to see if there've been any more developments, any arrests made or any bodies discovered. But each time there's nothing about Philip Hayward, Tara or the hideaway. I consider Googling him for his office number, but I'm worried that it'll look as though I'm stalking him, and he has his daughter to think about. He's bound to be tied up looking after her. After all, as far as I know, he hasn't done anything wrong. Anyway, it's up to the police now. 15.
There are no such things as coincidences,
Sylvia says, when we visit her on the first Sunday we're back.
I'm glad you left when you did.
We're sitting around a large dining table, eating a roast dinner. Jamie began telling them all about the holiday, but he'd recounted it in a witty, breezy way, not revealing how anxious we've been feeling about it since we arrived home 3 days ago. He doesn't mention the food poisoning, wanting to keep the story light. I can tell he thought it'd be a funny tale to regale his family with, and he doesn't anticipate Sylvia's horror, although he should have done, knowing how overprotective she can be.
I can't believe you found dead animals in their basement,
interjects Florrie's husband, Richard, through a mouthful of roast potato. Jamie gets on quite well with Richard, but then Jamie gets on well with everyone. I think Richard's a bit immature. He's the sort of person who falls about laughing if someone steps in dog poo, and I've heard Florrie moaning to her mother that he stays up half the night playing on the Xbox and can't get up for work the next day. There's something a little sleazy about him, too. The way his eyes linger too long on your breasts, or how he can't quite meet your eye. When Katie wears short skirts, which is more often than not, I notice how his gaze sweeps over her legs. Florrie nudges him in the ribs and scowls. He glances at me and pulls a comical face.
And I can't believe, says Sylvia,
in a cut-glass accent, turning her flint-coloured eyes on me,
that you let my son languish in hospital without telling me.
There's a collective intake of breath around the table. Florrie puts a knife and fork down with a clatter. Katie's wine glass freezes at her lips, and Richard looks at me with a smirk on his face, as though he's a kid at school, delighted that I've been told off by the teacher. Hannah sits quietly at the end of the table, opposite Jamie, her large eyes watching me. Her little boy Felix and Florrie's son Jacob are the only ones unaffected by Sylvia's exclamation. The chicken I'm chewing feels like rubber in my mouth. I swallow painfully.
I didn't want to worry you.
Her finely shaped eyebrows, so like her son's, knit together.
It's a mother's job to worry. Thank goodness Hannah told me.
Hannah?
I meet her cool, challenging gaze. How did Hannah know? And then I remember the text message she sent Jamie. With all the drama of leaving the hideaway and fleeing back to Bath, I'd forgotten to ask him about it. I can just imagine his text, apologising for not replying sooner because he'd been in hospital, discussing their secret and keeping it hidden from me. I feel an intense dislike for her then.
Mum, leave her alone, says Jamie mildly. I'm 30 years old, you don't need to know my every movement.
Sylvia's face softens. She has an attractive face when she isn't being judgmental, with striking grey eyes framed by her blonde fringe. She always dresses well, thinking it important to accessorise. She likes chunky jewellery and is never without a wristful of bangles. These jangle now as she pours gravy over a chicken.
But you were in hospital, Jamie, love. What if something had happened?
I had a bit of food poisoning, that's all. And that's not the worst of it. We found... He lowers his voice, as so not to frighten the children. Some clothing. Underwear, ripped and covered in blood. Ziggy dug it up. We called the police, they're taking it very seriously. There's a stunned silence.
Blimey, what a holiday!
Proclaims Richard eventually, sitting back in his chair.
Finding sexy underwear in the garden and having the shits!
Hardly sexy, I mutter. Appalled at his crassness.
Richard!
Florrie prods him again. She seems to spend her whole life being embarrassed by her husband.
Mummy, what does the shits mean?
Asks Felix, glancing up at Hannah with the same big eyes. Hannah looks furious and glares at me as though it's my fault.
Uncle Richard said a bad word,
she says, turning her attention to her son. Their name jars, but I push it out of my mind and distract Felix by asking him to show me the new cuddly seal that he's brought with him. He's soon telling me all about Snowy, and Richard's words are forgotten. I'm rewarded by a grateful and rare smile from Hannah. For the rest of the afternoon, I watch the interaction between Jamie and Hannah, scrutinising them for signs that they're keeping something from me. They disappear at one point, and I find them in the kitchen. I can tell by their body language that they're having heart to heart. She's standing with her back against the worktop, and he's so close that their shoulders are touching. She looks pretty, in a knee-length floral dress, long boots and a denim jacket. He has his arms resting loosely across his stomach, his legs crossed at the ankle, and they're talking in murmurs. As soon as I walk in, they spring apart. Hannah reaching up to the cupboard to get a glass and Jamie inexplicably opening the microwave. What's going on? I say, my voice cold, Hannah glances at me, her face a picture of innocence.
What do you mean?
Well, why have you disappeared in here?
We're just having a private conversation,
she says, and I want to slap her smug face.
That's still allowed now that he's married, isn't it?
She smiles sweetly, then brushes past me and out of the room. Probably running to tell it all to Katie and they'll gossip in the corner like two teenagers, instead of the 28-year-old women that they are. Jamie can't meet me, as he closes the microwave door. He's empty-handed. What's she playing at? I hiss. Jamie shakes his head. Libs, I've known her for years.
I don't care, she wants you for herself. She doesn't see me like that anymore.
I groan.
Are you that naive? And even if she did, it doesn't matter. She's just a friend, that's all. You should know this by now, Libs.
He strides over to me. She's just got a problem she wants some help with, that's all. You do trust me, don't you? I sense an undercurrent of irritation beneath his jovial tone. I've always been secure in his love for me, even though I've sensed that his family don't like me much. Except maybe Flory. So why do I feel this way now? This fear that I'm about to lose him, that everything's unravelling. Is it because of what happened in Cornwall? Or the fire and the miscarriage? I'm not sure.
You told me yourself Hannah really loves you. She thought you were the one, Jay.
He looks down at his feet and shuffles, clearly uncomfortable.
We were kids.
You broke her heart. We were too serious too quickly. Then we went to different universities and things, well, you know how it is.
Cheated on her?
The realization suddenly hits me. He's never admitted that to me before, but it's in his expression. The downcast eyes, the sheepish smile.
Guilt.
He shuffles and glances down at his Converse. I'm not proud of that.
Why have you never told me before?
Like I said, I'm not proud of it. He lifts his head up, but doesn't smile or make a joke. I'm pleased he's not trying to make light of it. I stare at him. He's capable of cheating. Jamie Hall, who I've always thought was so black and white, so moralistic, so well-bred. He's no better than my father. Than Harry.
Libs, why are you staring at me like that? As though you don't know who I am. Jesus, it was a lifetime ago. I was young and stupid. I wasn't in love. Not like I am with you.
He moves towards me.
Please don't make a big deal out of this.
I swallow and try to compose myself.
I'm not. I don't know. How could I not have known this? We've been together nearly 5 years. Did he keep it from me deliberately?
I think back to all those early conversations, intertwined on my single bed in a shabby bedsit where we were finding out about each other. About past relationships. He pulls me to him, wrapping his arms around my waist. It was different then. I was different. I would never do anything like that to you. I hope you know that. I don't care how Anna feels about me. It's you I love. You I married. You I want to be with for the rest of my life.
I'm glad to hear it,
I say. From beyond the doorway, I catch a flash of floral, a swish of blonde hair. Has Hannah been standing there this whole time, listening? I lean into him and rest my head on his chest, trying to ignore my unease. It's a cold day, with a crisp blue sky and a low sun. After lunch, I sit in the conservatory, enjoying the warmth filtering in through the glass, watching Felix and Jacob wrapped up warm, sprinting up and down the vast lawn. Jamie and Richard running after them. Hannah and Flory look on adoringly, their arms folded. Being back here with his family, it's easy to forget the events of the past week. Almost as though we've never been to Cornwall. Despite the years we've been together, I still can't get over how large this house is. That this is where he spent his childhood. So different from the two up, two down I'd grown up in. They even have a coach house at the bottom of the garden where their guests sleep. Sylvia's always having friends to stay over. I sense she likes it best when a house is filled with people and laughter and chatter. And despite the fact that she annoys me at times, I feel for her, not having a husband around anymore. I watch as Jamie dribbles a ball, and Felix runs after him, laughing, his arms outstretched.
Jamie cheated on Hannah. I still can't believe it. It's as though he's shifted slightly in my perception, like catching sight of him through one of those fun mirrors at a fairground.
Don't you want to go out and join them?
Her voice makes me jump. I turn to see Katie reclining against the doorframe,
an insolent expression on her face.
She has the same dirty blonde hair as her mum and Jamie, whereas Florrie's dark like their dad. Katie's a pretty girl, all long arms and slender legs, but there's something restless about her, as though she doesn't really know where she belongs. Boomeranging from one job to another, one boyfriend to another, and one home to another. She's recently moved back in with Sylvia, and is jobless once more, even though she's only 2 years younger than me. Sylvia's never said it. She's intensely loyal to all three of her children, but I know that she worries about Katie. Her lack of direction. I would have given anything for the privileges and the expensive education that she obviously takes for granted. Even though Florrie is the archetypal bossy older sister, I prefer her to Katie. Florrie's more down-to-earth, more solid, even if we don't share the same taste in men. Not that Rich is a bad bloke, he's just a bit of a prat at times. Katie, on the other hand, is manipulative, playing a role as the baby of the family to suit her needs. But not with me. I can see straight through her. I turn to her, with what I hope is a don't-mess-with-me look on my face. The kind I give my pupils when they play up. She ignores it, and sits down opposite me on one of the rattan sofas. She swings her legs around so they're hanging over the arm. There's a wedding photo of me and Jamie above her head. Florrie and Katie flanking us, resplendent in pale blue. I remember how much of a diva Katie had been about the wedding. How she refused to wear blue as it washed her out. How she accused me of trying to make her look bad as though it was all about her. I'd bitten my tongue, of course, although I refused to change the colour of the bridesmaids' dresses. Jamie informed her firmly that she either wore the colour I'd chosen or stepped down as bridesmaids. Not for the first time I wished I'd had my own sister to stand by my side on that day. To find my corner. It's hard sometimes, standing up to the hall women. Katie's quietly assessing me with her cool gaze.
You're so quiet sometimes, Libby. Who knows what goes on inside your head? You should be out there with your husband instead of letting him play daddy to Hannah's kid.
I fix a smile on my face, unwilling to rise to the bait. It's nice for him to spend time with his family, and I'm still feeling a bit off-colour. I touch my stomach to illustrate my point. And with my arm, you know. I lift my cast and pull a disappointed face. I don't want to fall over when the cast is coming off next week. She chews her lip thoughtfully.
I suppose you don't want to play with kids when you're looking after them all day.
It's not that. I love kids.
But it must be weird,
she continues relentlessly, crossing her legs at the ankle and wiggling her toes. Her nails are painted a dark purple.
To see your husband with his ex-girlfriend. I remember how in love they were once upon a time. First love. That's a powerful thing, isn't it? We all thought they'd get married. Funny how things turn out, don't you think?
I wonder if she continues to see Hannah just to wind me up. It's true they've been best friends for years, but Hannah, now a mother, has outgrown Katie. It's always struck me as odd how Katie parades Hannah around the house like some kind of prize pig. Well, I've been seeing them together for 5 years, so I'm used to it. I say pleasantly, my tone belying my irritation. I'm like a tennis pro, the way I bat away her digs. I've had enough practice over the years. It's as if she knows exactly what to say to get to me, but I never show her how much her words sting. It'd been strange at first, knowing Jamie's ex was still a part of the family. Hannah had been heavily pregnant and still married when I first met her, and I quickly realised I'd never have the sort of relationship with Sylvia that they share, the sort of relationship that I'd hoped for, had craved. I assumed before I met Jamie's mum that she would fill the void my own mum had left behind when she died, that Sylvia would become a sort of surrogate. But of course it isn't as simple as that. Sylvia couldn't be more different to my own mother. It's as though she doesn't feel I'm quite good enough for Jamie, that I'm not the daughter-in-law she'd been hoping for, with my northern accent, my preference for a pint of lager over a glass of wine, my chip nails, my clothes stained with marker pens, I'm not what she calls well turned out. Once I saw her looking with distaste at the tattoo of a winged bird on my upper arm. She doesn't like that I'm competitive at board games. That I don't iron Jamie's clothes. I don't even iron my own clothes. That I have 3 piercings in my left ear, or that I'm not constantly on a diet or talking about food or baking. My saving grace is that I'm a teacher. I can almost hear her telling her friends at the Women's Institute that at least I have an education. Hannah, on the other hand, fills that void with her posh girls' school education and her family money, even if she is now a divorced single mum. Jamie confided in me once that Hannah's family were utter snobs, and he never really liked them, because they were so disinterested in Hannah, putting all their efforts and ambition into their Oxford-educated son instead. They moved to Jersey a few years ago, and so Jamie tells me Hannah hardly sees them. Katie frowns now, twirling a section of her hair around her finger.
Yes, well, I wouldn't like my husband being so close to his ex, but then we're different, aren't we?
She smiles sweetly and jumps up from the sofa, bored that she isn't getting a rise out of me. I long to tell her to grow up. But I pick up a magazine from the coffee table and start leafing through it instead. I can sense her watching me by the door, but I keep my eyes on the page, pretending to be engrossed in the private life of a soap star.
I know you think I'm pretty thick.
Her words cut into the silence. I'm so shocked the magazine slips from my lap and onto the stone floor. I snap my head up. No, I don't. I think you're actually very clever. It's true, she is. She just uses her intelligence in the wrong way by being sly.
I might not have a degree like you, but I know about people, and I know about you. You like to think you're so together, so strong, but you're like a swan. On the surface, you're all elegant and in control, but underneath it, all your legs are desperately kicking to stay afloat.
Katie,
it doesn't mean you're weak to show that you're not perfect, you know.
I know that. I don't think I'm perfect. Far from it. How can she know that most of the time I feel like an imposter? She narrows her eyes as though wanting to say more, but thinks better of it, tossing her hair back and flouncing out of the room. Outside the window, Sylvia's handing out tea from a circular tray, the steam rising from the assorted collection of bone china mugs. Jamie and Hannah are in conversation on the edge of the group. She's leaning into him and laughing at something he's saying. And it irks me that even after our earlier conversation, he's still indulging her. She sees me watching and smirks. I feel a spark of anger. She should be careful who she messes with. I've put everything I've got into creating my life with Jamie, and I won't let her or anyone else ruin it for me. 16. 2 days before Good Friday, I finally have the cast removed. I almost skip home from the hospital, ecstatic that I'm no longer restricted by the sling. That I can now take Ziggy for walks again, or go for a run or play badminton. All the things I'd enjoyed before the fire. Evelyn's sitting at her window as I descend the steps to our basement flat and I give her a wave. She waves back, and I vow to pop over to see her later. I fumble with my key. The new lock's a bit stiff and the door seems to resist as I push it open. I soon realise why. The post has arrived, and it's clogging up the hallway. I bend over to pick up the junk mail that's dropped through the letterbox, 10 times the amount we usually receive. I flick through it, frowning. All are addressed to me, and seem to be from companies selling everything from the mundane to the obscure to the downright rude. I throw them onto the worktop. An lewd advert about a penis enlargement kit glares up at me. I screw it up and shove it in the bin, surprised when I see what's underneath it. The same catalogue that was in the hideaway, with all that expensive Scandinavian furniture. Surely I didn't order this. What did I? I throw it onto the sideboard, where it skids across the wood, only stopping when it knocks against an ornament. The Buddha? What's that doing here? I haven't laid eyes on it for years, but I couldn't bring myself to part with it, so I kept it hidden away. Did Jamie find it and put it out? I study the Buddha's calm face, his relaxed pose, turning it over in my hands. I can't look at it without thinking of everything that's happened. It has to go. The door to the spare room is firmly shut, and I can hear Jamie talking on the phone. Something about infrastructure and databases.
I still don't really understand what he does, even though he's always trying to explain it to me. I carry the Buddha into the bedroom and shove it to the back of my wardrobe, underneath a pile of summer clothes. When I return to the kitchen, I switch the kettle on, desperate for a cup of tea, and still missing the instant tap at the hideaway. Siggy springs up from his bed. "Sorry, boy, I've not said hello yet," I say, enjoying the freedom of hugging him. I bury my face in his fur. He needs a bath. In fact, I think as I stand up, this whole flat smells of dog. I light the candle on the pine sideboard at the dining room end of the kitchen, taking deep breaths of the mandarin scent. The candle really cheers up the room, with its flicker and crackle. It doesn't have quite the same effect as it did in the hideaway, but the smell reminds me of the Cornwall house. Expensive and exotic. Jamie pads into the kitchen. He hasn't shaved for a few days. The stress that had lingered around him like bad aftershave before Cornwall is back. And not for the first time, I worry that becoming self-employed is too much pressure for him. He's holding a parcel by the tips of his fingers, as though he's loath to touch it. It knocks against his leg as he walks. I wave my right arm at him. "The cast's gone," I say, feeling euphoric. "That's great news," he replies, beaming at me, his eyes twinkling. "What have you got up there?" His face closes up. "It's for you. What have you been ordering?" "I haven't made my first million yet," he jokes. His eyes go to the candle. "And where did that come from?" I bought it cheap from the charity shop," I lie. "Must have been an unused gift or something." He won't approve if I tell him the truth, that I took it from the hideaway. I justified it to myself that as we'd used it when we were on holiday, Tara wouldn't have expected us just to leave it behind. Jamie might not see it that way, though. "I've not ordered anything." I take the parcel from him. It's large and heavy. The name of a well-known catalogue company emblazoned down the side of the orange plastic envelope. I don't even have any catalogues. I rip it open. "What is it?" he asks, going over to the kettle and pouring the boiling water into two mugs. I frown. "It looks like some kind of bag," I say, as it slides from its packaging. "It's large. Ugly. The type of backpack a student might take travelling. I definitely didn't order this." I double-check the name on the front, hoping there's been some mistake and it's meant for one of the neighbours, but it's definitely addressed to me. Jamie places a mug of tea on the table in front of me. "Going somewhere, Libs?" he laughs. But it's not funny. Cold fingers creep down my back. Why have I been sent this? I dump it on the table and then ferret inside the packaging to find the order form. "This is weird, Jay. It appears I have an account with them, look." I wave the piece of paper under his nose. He narrows his eyes and takes it from me. "I've never set up an account." "It's obviously some sort of error," he says, with a dismissive shrug, handing me back the form. "Just ring them and tell them, send the bag back." I sigh. "Ugh, but it's such a faff." "I know, Libs, but these things happen." Cradling his mug, he wanders out of the room. I stuff the bag back into its packaging and refasten it. The sky darkens and it starts to rain as I walk to the post office. The niggling feeling about the bag stalks me. Does it mean something? Is it personal? I remember walking those dusty sunbaked streets in Thailand with a similar bag on my back weighing me down. I'm so distracted I almost bump into a woman with a baby strapped to her front. I apologise and she smiles in that tired yet euphoric way that new mothers do. And my heart twists. I would have been nearly 4 months pregnant by now. Would I have had a bump? A glow? And the other one, the first. The streets are busy, with families enjoying the last week of the Easter holidays. Wrapped up in waterproofs, the streets, a sea of umbrellas. The traffic's starting to build up as I get closer to the high street, and lights are coming on in the windows I pass, despite it only being 4 p.m. The amount of post I've received that morning plays on my mind as I queue at the post office. All those advertising round robins and promises of 15% off from companies that I've never even bought anything from. Why would they suddenly send me stuff? Just getting rid of the bag makes me feel lighter.
As around the corner to our street, I sense somebody close behind me. I stop and turn abruptly. A woman snapping at my heels. Her face is obscured by her umbrella, but I see long, straggly hair and clunky biker boots. I walk on more slowly. But she doesn't go around me, she slows too. Is she following me? I stop and stand aside to let her pass, annoyed that she's invading my space. She strides past, not giving me a second glance. When I arrive back at the flat, Jamie's out with Ziggy. So I retrieve my laptop from the living room to conduct what has become a daily ritual of scrolling through Cornish websites for news. As usual, there's nothing. It's dusk by the time I've finished, and Jamie's still out with Ziggy, so I put a pan of pasta on the hob. I feel jittery and anxious. The parcel and the letters still at the back of my mind. I can hear Evelyn's radio on upstairs. She always has it turned up too loud, but I find it comforting. Later in the evening, the radio will be replaced by the TV, and it won't be long before I'll hear the theme tune to one of the many soaps she watches. I strain the pasta over the sink. My gaze goes into the window and the pavement above. Ziggy's sitting under the street lamp, and I can just make out a pair of legs next to him. I lean over the sink to get a better view. Jamie's talking to a man in a pinstripe suit and dark overcoat. I vaguely recognise him from one of the big houses further down the road. A three-storey detached home with its own driveway. I've seen him getting into a flashy sports car. His wife is an attractive woman. Younger than him and very glamorous. Never without lipstick and several coats of mascara on her long lashes. Her glossy dark hair always blow-dried in loose waves. The glow of the lamppost illuminates the fine rain that falls softly onto Ziggy's coat. Why is Jamie standing there talking in the rain? I can see that the man looks furious and he's waving something in Jamie's face. I run to the front door and open it just in time to see the man striding away. Jamie's expression's closed as he descends the steps with Ziggy lolloping close behind. The rain has darkened Ziggy's golden coat, and his fur is furrowed between the eyes so it looks as though he's frowning. Was that the guy from down the road? What did he want? I ask, as soon as Jamie steps over the threshold. He shrugs off his coat and hangs it on the peg while I rub Ziggy down with an old towel. Yep, Martin. Such a twat. What did he want? I repeat, when it's obvious Jamie isn't going to volunteer any more information. Oh, it was nothing. I feel my hackles rising. It didn't look like nothing. He stalks off into the kitchen and I follow. The served pasta sits on the side, growing cold. I return it to the saucepan and add some of the tomato sauce I defrosted earlier. I begin stirring the pasta so vigorously that sauce spits over the side and onto the hob with a sizzle. Jamie comes up behind me and wraps his arms around my waist. Don't be mad, Libs. Then why can't you tell me what it's about? He sighs, his breath hot on my neck. It's actually a bit embarrassing. Cross wires, it has to be. I sit on my heels to face him. What do you mean? Martin accosted me as I was walking home with Ziggy, said I'd been sending his wife love letters. He has the good grace to blush. What? I drop the wooden spoon in shock, and we both watch as it clatters to the floor, splashing tomato sauce onto the cabinet. I tut heavily and grab a dishcloth from the sink, wiping the floor in the cupboard. Jamie sidesteps me and turns down the hob. I know, it's ridiculous. Well, they weren't really love letters. More like cards, romantic cards. He gives a disbelieving laugh. I don't even know his wife. Didn't even know her name until today. It's Anya, apparently. But you've seen her, this Anya. Even you can't have failed to notice how attractive she is. Well, yes, he says helplessly. I suppose she is attractive, but I've only ever said hello. Sometimes we pass each other when she's out running and I'm walking Ziggy. I can feel the heat flood my face. I think of Jamie cozying up to Ruth at Lizard Point, or chatting with Hannah. Their bodies touching. He's a bit of a flirt, I've always thought so. So he showed you one of the cards? I say, still scrubbing the floor. He practically shoved it in my face. I stand up to rinse the cloth under the tap, trying to remain calm. I think of Katie's swan analogy. She's right. That's me. Beneath it all, I'm kicking furiously, trying not to drown. And was it your writing?
Of course it wasn't, Libs.
He grabs my arm and swings me around to face him.
You don't think I'd do anything like that, do you?
No. No, of course not. I look past his shoulder.
You don't sound too sure.
I am, it's just...
It's just what?
I raise my eyes to his. We've been married for 9 months. That's all. And together 4 years before that.
Long enough, surely.
But how well do you ever really know someone?
And he cheated on Hannah.
I can't help the words that slip from my lips.
I saw the text Hannah sent you.
The text Hannah sent?
When you were in hospital, I didn't read it all. It popped up on your phone.
I thought you were cool about Hannah now. I thought you understood. She's just a friend.
My face grows hot with anger.
You know how she feels about you, and guess what? I think you like it.
His eyes widen in surprise.
What? You like the attention? Would you be so understanding if my ex-boyfriend was invited to every fucking family dinner? If I stood next to him in the garden having cozy little chats? If he sent me texts asking me to keep secrets?
I'm so angry that spittle is flying from my mouth. I'm usually careful to control my temper in front of Jamie, in front of everyone, but all the fear, the resentment that's been building up is erupting out of me.
Surprise registers on his face, but I'm on a roll now. And don't say I'm paranoid or bloody irrational. I can't stand it when you say that. It's so patronising. And yes, I am jealous. I'm jealous of the fact that you put her feelings before mine. That your family seem to like her more than me. That when we're around your mum's house, I feel so redundant, so unwelcome. My family have always welcomed you. No, they haven't. The only one who is nice to me is Florrie.
There's a stunned silence. I've run out of steam now, so I throw the wet cloth in the sink. Eventually, Jamie speaks.
Libs, I'm sorry, but you have to trust me. I trust you.
A pang of guilt rips through me.
I've not given you any reason not to,
I mumble.
There's lots I don't know about you. You never talk about your childhood. You never even want to go to Yorkshire. You never tell me anything about your parents. You keep everything bottled up, even what happened in Thailand. I know you haven't told me the full story there. What do you want to know?
I glare at him, my hands on my hips.
I think you were badly hurt by someone. Someone you loved.
He moves towards me, his eyes soft. I think your friend's death has really affected you. It's made you anxious about taking risks, trying anything new. You like to hide from anything that you deem dangerous, like flying or driving a car.
But you can't... Look what happened at the school. An accident that you couldn't have prevented even if you spent your life trying to assess risk.
Don't try and psychoanalyze me. You sound like your mother.
All I want to know is, did you send Anya those letters?
He backs away from me, his body heavy with disappointment. The softness in his eyes gone. I watch his face carefully to see if he's lying. No, I didn't. But it hurts me that you even have to ask. He looks sincere. I move towards him, my hand outstretched, a sorry on my lips, but he walks out of the room. I can't sleep that night. I toss and turn, the sheets twisting beneath me, hot with anxiety. All I can think about is Martin accusing Jamie. After we rowed, I apologised over slightly burnt pasta, and he'd reassured me it was a case of mistaken identity. They would never cheat on me or hurt me.
But Martin must have a reason to think it was Jamie.
And even though I believe Jamie when he says he hadn't sent them, it unnerves me to think that someone wants Martin, possibly me, to think that Jamie has.
17. The next day, another parcel's hanging out of our letterbox from the same catalogue company. I recognise the garish orange wrapping instantly.
Don't open it,
warns Jamie, as I sit with it in front of me at the kitchen table. He's standing by the kettle. His eyes are tired. He was up until 1 a.m. working.
You know you didn't order it, so just return it.
I need to know what it is. I can't help but think these parcels are personal.
He hands me a mug of tea. Why?
I don't know, but the Haywards... They stayed here. They had access to our information. How do I know this isn't down to them?
He opens his mouth to tell me not to be paranoid. But when he notices my expression, he shuts it again. I tentatively tear open the plastic. He looks like some kind of wig. Long and golden brown. What can this mean?
What is it?
Jamie peers over my shoulder.
A wig? Why would anyone send me a wig?
I touch my own hair self-consciously to check that it hasn't started falling out.
He doesn't say anything. And when I swivel around in my chair, I notice he's moved away from me and is looking out the window. He has his back to me, so I can't see his face, but from the rigidness of his body, I can tell he's tense.
Jamie, are you okay?
It's then I notice the phone pressed to his ear. I didn't hear it ring. He walks out of the room into his office, phone clamped to his ear. It must be a work call, I think, as I pick up my own phone and dial the catalogue company. Or Hannah? I push this thought away. The woman I speak to is helpful, informing me that I'd opened an account last Thursday at 10 a.m, the day we were returning from Cornwall, and had ordered the bag and the wig online 20 minutes later. I try to keep the frustration out of my voice as I inform her that there is some mistake, that I haven't opened an account or ordered anything.
Please can you close it? I ask. And if someone tries to open another account under my name, can you let me know? It's very important.
She assures me she'll do as I ask, but I feel unsettled as I put the phone down. Why would someone do this to me? When I return from the post office, soaked through from a downpour because I've forgotten my umbrella, a man I don't recognise is sitting drinking tea at the kitchen table with Jamie. He's wearing a Columbo-style Macintosh, with dark patches on the shoulders and back where he's been pelted with rain. He looks to be in his late 50s, with a stern face and thick bifocal glasses perched on his nose.
Libby.
Jamie pushes back his chair when he sees me. His face is devoid of colour, making his stubble look more prominent. His whole demeanour is tense. This is D.S. Burns. He's got some news about the Haywards. I slide into a chair wordlessly. My eyes dart to Jamie to try and ascertain his emotions, but his face is closed. His lips press together so tightly that they turn white. I brace myself for news of Tara's murder. Spending time in her home amongst the decor that she had chosen, the photographs on her wall, with her beautiful clothes hanging in the wardrobe, I feel her loss even though I've never known her. But I can't bear the tension any longer. Is she dead? I blurt out.
Who?
Asks D.S. Burns, frowning.
Tara Haywood.
Why would you think that she's dead, Mrs. Hall? His voice is calm, but I can hear the note of suspicion.
Is it directed at us?
Does he think we have something to do with Tara's death?
Because of the clothing that we found in the garden, the blood.
He stares at me in a way that makes me feel on edge, as though I've done something wrong.
No, she's not dead. Both the Haywards are alive and well, you'll be pleased to hear. We finally managed to locate them. They've been away.
Well, yes. I frown. Of course they've been away, I want to shout. They've been here. He carries on, as if I haven't spoken.
They live in London, where they've been for months.
He peers at me, over the rim of his thick glasses.
They've never heard of you, or...
He inclines his head in Jamie's direction.
Mr. Hall. They knew nothing about the house swap. In fact, they were under the impression that their Cornwall home was empty.
I can tell by James' body language that he's already been told this news. Shock renders me speechless for a few seconds. D.S. Burns assesses me coolly.
But I don't understand.
Neither do we, he says in the same grave voice.
Can you tell me from the beginning everything that happened that led to this so-called house swap?
I notice he has an A4 notepad and pen in front of him. He clicks the end of the pen with his thumb and presses it against the paper, turning to me expectantly. Jamie leans across the table and gives my hand a reassuring squeeze. Go and get the leaflet, Libs. I leap out of my chair and hurry into the hallway. I'd shoved the leaflet in the top drawer of the unit by the door, just in case I'd lost Philip's number or there'd been a problem. Not that I'd been expecting anything like this. I rummage through the door, taking all the papers out and rifling through them. But the leaflet is nowhere to be found.
With a sinking feeling, I return to the kitchen. I can't find it, I say.